Skyline's new chicken chili is here. Now you can enjoy that legendary Skyline taste with a new protein option. Try Skyline's chicken chili on Waze, Coney's, and all your Skyline favorites. Feeling good? It's Skyline time.
Hello and welcome to the Undercut Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jesse Billington, and I'm joined by just the one co-host this evening, Timo. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm not doing too badly, actually. I'm getting into the Christmas spirit of things. Of course, we're recording this on the 13th of December. It's well into the holiday season now, and I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, we've had a nice break from Formula One for a couple of weeks, so it seems apt to do season review now, when we've had that distance to kind of see, was that what we thought of it, or was it not? And you should have to listen on to find out.
Yeah, we've had some time to mull it over. Of course, you haven't heard the usual third voice on this podcast. You would have Ellie May on with us, but she's currently recovering from injuries sustained in the line of duty as a podcaster. She walked under a perilously suspended piano, which then fell on her. When she stood up, not only was she crumpled into an accordion, but also all of her teeth turned piano keys and fell out, making a plink, plink, plonk noise on the pavement. So we wish her well as she gets better. And hopefully she'll be back in due course. Definitely by season's start, I think, is what she's told me.
Does that mean she's not coming on then?
It does indeed mean she's not coming on. Thank you. Is that it? Okay.
That was
the preconditioned bit, was it? Okay. With that out of the way, we've got a little bit of news to dive into, actually, because despite the fact that we've been off the air for what feels like an eon, but it's probably been 2 weeks, most of which I spent with norovirus. Didn't really need that detail. There's still some news to go over, so we'll dive into that. And the first thing is one that really came out of nowhere, and it's the fact the Spanish Grand Prix has reportedly signed a contract to host the race in Madrid from 2026 for 10 years. This would see Barcelona lose its place on the calendar. We're not having any double Spanish Grand Prix, and it's, in a surprise to no one really, a street circuit within Madrid. So it goes around the IFEMA Convention Center, which it's got a roundabout in it. And Spain has loads
of... As has been shown already with countless memes and GIFs about how well that's going to go.
Yes, yeah.
So great amusement.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, what's the IndyCar one that's usually like second or third in the season? That has the sort of little...
Oh, yeah, Long Beach. To be fair, up until the first year I started watching, which was last year, they'd had no incidents with that. And then as soon as I started watching, everyone seemed to think, oh, there's a roundabout there. Let's drive into it. And it was brilliant.
So many people crash at that point in Long Beach. So I think they should keep the roundabout in if we go to Madrid. But the fact is, Spain has loads of other racing circuits and decent FIA Grade 1 ones at that. So we've got so many brilliant circuits in Spain. MotoGP utilizes a couple of them. They provide fantastic racing. So what's with the constant Formula E-ification of F1? Why more street circuits?
Yeah, it does seem a weird thing that Formula E and F1 are swapping around a bit on that side of things. But also, it's been one of those rumors about Madrid that's been around for a while, but you kind of hoped it would just be that. And again, I'm not sure if... because none of this is confirmed yet, but they also want it to be a night race, which... leave that alone. We've got enough as it is. And the whole point in Singapore being the only night race was that it was meant to be unique. And if you start doing something all the time, it no longer becomes unique. We don't need another street circuit anyway. It's getting to the point where it's getting perilously close to 50-50, which we don't need. And we're already looking at street tracks on the calendar thinking, you know, we can get rid of a few of you easily because, again, we don't need that many of you. If we want street racing, we go to Formula E. We watch the Macau Grand Prix, XYZ. And yeah, it's, no one really asked for it. No one wants it. And I know Barcelona has not been the best Grand Prix of the season over the last few years, but I'd still prefer that to another bloody street race. This isn't Fast and Furious.
This is the thing, yeah. Like, Barcelona's not great, but equally it's not a street race. And I mean, we think street races are sometimes great, but I mean, look at Baku. This year was a bit dull, and Baku has previously been a bit interesting, or it sort of swings from being interesting to cack. But with the current setups and the current style of car, I think we're looking at street circuits being a bit pants. I think Las Vegas got lucky because the circuit was so green and had so little grip, it turned out to be interesting. Singapore was good because, of course, we had Lawson out qualifying the Red Bulls and Stroll crashing in Q1.
Well, it's important to note as well that Vegas, we have the one-off there, so we don't know quite what we're doing with that. Singapore, I don't think there's ever really been a bad race. You just had good and great.
Mm.
Everywhere else, Saudi was built for the sake of spice, shall we say, for being diplomatic. Miami's done nothing. Baku has been pretty good on the whole, couple of does, but I put that down to more to the regulations than anything. And, well, we don't, Monaco, you leave it there because even if the racing's not perfect, that's more down to the sheer size of the bloody cars more than anything. You see, can see that with any other category where they've got smaller cars, you can overtake and you can do stuff. That's plenty. You don't need, you've got already three night races there. You've got a classic Grand Prix circuit. You've got a daytime street race, which is great with Baku. At most, you could maybe rotate, but you don't need to keep adding stuff onto it. It's just not necessary. And I mean, if you think of Canada and Australia, technically they're street circuits as well, because they're not racetrack tracks. So, Christ, leave it on. You don't need more.
Yeah, I don't think
we've got plenty.
Yeah, I don't think we need any additional ones, any street circuits, certainly. Like, could we have not just sort of gone to a different Spanish circuit just to try and mix it up before we decided to build a street circuit?
If you wanted a street race in Spain, and if you wanted at night, revive Valencia.
This is the other option. At least Valencia did give us some interesting racing, even if it was a bit of a cack circuit to watch. Like, it didn't look great on telly.
Hamilton drama crashing and Mark Webber going flying through the air, Schumacher's podium. There's some memorable moments.
It was an interesting circuit for the races it provided, but like visually, it wasn't stunning in the same way that like Canada and Australia are visually stunning street circuits where you whip past the trees and everything.
The amount of money that's going to get pumped into Madrid as a result of doing this, though, you could easily pump into Valencia and revitalize the entire area if you wanted to.
To be fair, that area of Valencia has sort of...
Oh, yeah, it's gone downhill a little bit, so...
Quite literally by the quayside.
You could... there'd be a great story in there, and you could make it all green and environmentally friendly and meeting your 2030 goals and yada, yada, yada. Do I have to do everything for me, Formula One?
And equally, if you did revive it, it'd then give you also a location to race Formula E as well, but...
Yeah.
And then,
what
then
the fuck
do
we know?
Then you could have them on the same weekend. You could have one as a feeder series to the other. It would be interesting. It would draw more eyes to Formula E. But no, they've just sort of... Basically, Madrid has gone, we've got some pesos. Do you want them? And Formula One's gone, yes, of course we do. So speaking of circuits with money, of course, we've got the 2024 sprint calendar that has also been announced in our little mini off season so far. We've got China, Miami, Austria, America, Brazil, and Qatar. Good picks, bad picks? I know you're pretty ambivalent towards the sprint in its entirety.
Well, yes, I mean, but if we have to have them, I'll be interested in China just because I'm looking forward to China as I really like the circuit. Miami, couldn't care less. It won't make it more interesting. Austria, sick to death of that at this point. Kota, pointless. It was a terrible sprint race this year. Did absolutely nothing. Brisbane and Qatar, fair enough. So 50-50.
Yeah, I think that's a fair argument there, really. Yeah, I'm interested in the China one. We haven't seen China for donkey's years on the calendar now. We would have last seen it in 2019, I want to say. Am I accurate with that?
Yeah, race 1000. Which was then suitably dull to go with such a momentous occasion.
Yeah, F1 sort of really hyping itself up to be nothing at all. So yeah, 2019 was the last time we've seen it. So it's going to be 5 years since we last raced in China. Obviously, the circuit's been used since then in things like Chinese F4 and so on. So it's not going to be a completely dead circuit like when we returned to Turkey. But it's going to be interesting to see how the new cars go there, especially through that very snaily turn one section. It's going to be good.
Yeah, I'm just looking forward to all of it. I'm hoping they don't make any changes to it last minute or anything like this. It's just, it's perfectly fun track as it is. And a lot of the drivers currently on the grid don't have experience with it. And even the ones that do, it's been 5 years.
Yeah, this is very true. Like anyone who joined in 2020, 2021 or so, we were not. Ooh, yeah.
I say, you've got Lewis, you've got Valtteri, Ricciardo, Alonso. After that, it gets tricky to think of who Perez probably. That, it's tricky to think who actually would have raced there.
Ocon, Gasly, Leclerc, Albon, Norris will have done. Russell will have done.
But only like one race.
Yeah, one race in the old style F1 car. Zhou will have done in his feeder series, I want to assume.
You'd think so.
Yeah, Sargeant won't have done.
Albon won't.
No, Albon will have done. He will have done it when he was at Toro Rosso.
Oh, yeah, I suppose. Yeah, but again, I'm just thinking it's one race virtually counts as nothing, though.
Yeah, one race in, again, a very old style of chassis. Like, it's going to be interesting, and there's going to be a lot to learn. So we'll see how that one pans out as it comes. Of course, we mentioned a couple of drivers there, Ocon and Gasly, who, of course, race for Alpine. And there is some news out of the Enstone-based team with Davide Brivio splitting from them after 3 years. No word on where he'll head or if the French outfit will bring in someone to fill the role of director of racing expansion projects. I think that some of Davide Brivio's role has been about getting Alpine into the world endurance class and going from there. So, of course, now Alpine have achieved that. He's not really got anywhere to expand the team beyond, so they've sort of got rid of him. But equally, this has been something that's echoed throughout Alpine's personnel management across the season, let's say. They've changed so many of their team, and do we think that's why we've not seen them perform as well as expected?
It's definitely a contributing factor. I mean, consistency seems to be the one thing they're allergic to the most this year. And yeah, it's kind of just not surprising to see yet another person leaving the team. It's kind of, do you want to have another role in here? Not really. I'm going to go somewhere else.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see where he heads.
Will we replace him? Maybe? Yeah, it's Alpine are just, we're all scratching our heads and they're scratching their heads too, because I think we've got about as much idea of what's going on as they do, and we're looking at each other going, you know, you've got to sort you out, right? Well, that's not our job. I mean, you could hire us, but that's not actually our job yet. And I also don't know if that would be wise to hire us. I mean, it would be interesting, and not just us collectively as in you and I, but just us as in the entire F1 community looking at you going, you know, you've got to fill those roles, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Although I think them hiring you and I to be sort of their racing directors across classes would be quite interesting.
Especially considering we'd be in charge of a French team.
Yeah.
I think that's all I need to say there.
Yeah, two people that have previously had views on the French. Though I will say at this point, actually, as much as I often joke about it, I do quite like the French. I'm a bit of a Francophile, if I may. Anyway, before we go too far down that route, we'll jump quickly to Extreme E, where news came out, I think it was today even, that Tanner Faust and Emma Gilmore are leaving their Extreme E team. So they're leaving McLaren, and no word yet on who will be replacing them, but who do we want to see in those seats? What, you're the big sort of upcoming talent hotshot spotter here. Who do you think we're going to see approaching McLaren's Extreme E team?
It would make sense for them to keep the driver in that they had already replacing Emma Gilmore, because she'd been out on injury after a big crash a couple of rounds ago in Hedda Hussas, and she did a nice job, and you want a bit of consistency. And I think if you're looking to have that balance within a team of youth and experience, and in Hedda's case, youthful experience, because she has been in and out of Extreme E and various different teams, keep her in. In that second seat, who knows? We have so many drivers coming in and out and trying things out with Extreme E that you could arguably get Sebastian Loeb or Nasser Latifi switching teams and going there. Or you could just have someone brand new. It's kind of hard to tell who's going to be in there. I mean, McLaren also have a range of other drivers available to them from their vast array of just driver programs, etc. So I'm not sure. I'm trying to think who else could be. No one's coming to mind as kind of an obvious contender, but I wouldn't mind someone new either, either from the world of rallying or Nitro Rallycross or something like this, where it makes sense at least that they're there. I'm looking at, you've got Nicholas Grunholm, I think, in World Rallycross, who is the only one there who hasn't been in Extreme E just yet, I don't think. So it's going to be interesting, but it's also that kind of silly season for a couple of teams, because I know that Clara Anderson's not going to be with ACT for next year, so there's a seat open up there. And as Robert Gex Racing proved back in season one when they won the championship, they have no trouble picking one of the drivers that helped them get that championship out of the team either. So we could see some very silly stuff yet, and you could get all kinds of wild moves all over the shop, which is why Extreme is quite fun in that respect as well. It's not like F1 at the moment where you'd be lucky if one or two seats change. This is, we could swap entire teams out just for the sake of it.
I think possibly picking from the classic rally scene, I know that Seb Perez is a name that's doing very well at the moment. He campaigned a Lancia Stratos on the Roger Albert Clark sort of rally across the UK last month. And he's a fantastic helmsmith when it comes to off-road stuff. Equally, I think I'm right in saying it's Oliver Solberg, son of Petter Solberg. Yes. Very handy chap behind the wheel.
He's very good.
Hey, y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Stuff, I reckon he'd be a perfect chew-in for McLaren's Extreme E team. If anything,
I wouldn't mind that. Fun. I wouldn't mind that either. But also, I was trying to think of anyone hyped McLaren just for the sake of we see everyone and their dog from all over the place in terms of racing categories come into it from new and old motorsport eras. Mika Häkkinen, why not?
Oh, that's not a ridiculous concept. I can see Mika doing it for a bit of a laugh.
And again, it's kind of, you've got a wide enough calendar in terms of there's a massive gap between rounds, and also you've got a lot of experience in one thing and doesn't necessarily guarantee that you're going to be good or bad. You just kind of learn as you go, and it's extreme for reason. As long as you survive some of the races, you're doing well. So you just have to outlast your competitors.
I think he has done a little bit of rallying, like the sort of grassroots stuff back in
Race of Champions, I think.
So it'd be interesting to see him make that move. But anyway, we'll jump into our final news story, which is a little more sensible, but also just as much nonsense. This largely revolves around the allegations that were thrown at Toto and Susie Wolff last month. Was this last month? Was this even this month? Was this December?
That was this month. It all happened at the beginning of this month and was over as quickly as it arrived because, well, it was nonsense.
Yeah, F1 Business, the slightly dodgy magazine in the UK that alleged that W Series failed because it wasn't sexy. So that gives you sort of the par that we're working on when it comes to journalism. They alleged that, was it that Susie Wolff was acting as an insider communicator for Toto Wolff and Mercedes? I think that's the gist of it.
I think it was slightly the other way around. She had information that she could only have gotten from Toto being inside a meeting that he was in that other people wouldn't have been able to, but it was all pretty much hearsay, very vague hearsay at that, because we're all just sitting there waiting down. Do we support her? Because this is a pretty serious allegation here, and that's surely, if I have taken it so seriously, there must be all kinds of evidence that they've got to be even opening an investigation to verify all this. And then everyone just kind of sat around and went, wait, you don't actually have any proof of anything whatsoever, like at all? There isn't even like a blurry photograph of Bigfoot in the background somewhere where you can maybe make something out? No? Okay. Well, I don't know what the hell you were thinking though.
Yeah, it was a concept that seemed to have materialized out of nowhere with no evidence to back it up. And then...
And made worse by the fact that she and everyone else found out at the same time. They didn't even talk to her privately beforehand to say, look, we're going to be doing this. Which is usually the kind of dumb thing of, we're going to inform the person or the team that we're investigating with maybe like a 5-minute head start on everyone else just to, for the sake of it's polite, if nothing else.
Which was, it was just a bit odd. But ultimately coming from F1 Business, not wholly surprising that that's the level they're working to. That's pretty much a quick recap of the news that's happened since we last recorded a podcast. So we'll dive into the main crux of what this is supposed to be, which is a review of the 2023 Formula One season. And we were talking about this before we hit record, and we reckon this is going to be a bit short from here onwards because it's not really been a season where much has happened.
Mercifully short, some would say.
Yes, yeah, it means we can get on to talking
because of the season, not because of us, but yes.
Yeah, because of the season, but it means we can get on to talking about Formula 2 and Formula 3 a lot quicker. But anyway, we'll jump straight in. We'll go just kick off with qualifying, and I've done some totting up of the head-to-head, not including the sprints, and including the sprints as well. Albon, in both instances, tops the charts. He dominated Sargeant 22-0 and 28-0, if you're including the sprint qualifying. If we include the sprint qualifying, just so you can get the broadest picture possible, Albon 28-0, Verstappen 25-3 against Perez, Alonso 24-4 against Stroll, Bottas 19-9 against Zhou. Norris achieved the same consistency against Piastri, 19-9. Tsunoda again scored the same consistency against all of his opponents, 19-9, 10-2 against De Vries, 6-4 against Ricciardo, and it was a 3-all tie against Lawson, interestingly. Leclerc was 18-10 to Sainz, Hülkenberg 18-10 against Magnussen, Gasly and Ocon 17-11, and Russell and Hamilton pretty equally matched on 15-13. If you don't include the sprints, Russell and Hamilton tie on qualifying stats, which is quite interesting.
I think the two stats that amuse me the most there are Verstappen and Perez for obvious reasons, and then Leclerc and Sainz, because despite being 18-10 ahead overall, Sainz finished way ahead of him in the championship standings, because of course he did with Leclerc's
level of luck across the season. Yes, it was very, very interesting in that regard. But yeah, I think the qualifying paints a relatively sort of interesting picture of the season, actually. In some cases, it's quite truthful to what we saw happen with the likes of Hülkenberg against Magnussen, the likes of Tsunoda against his opponents, Norris against Piastri. But like you said, when it comes to Leclerc Sainz, it was the opposite way around, really. We saw Sainz have the more consistent sort of races, but Leclerc often...
And Gasly and Ocon as well, it's this curious thing of it matters for them the least because of the season they had both individually and as a team. This doesn't matter because chances are you're not finishing the race anyway. And even when you do, it's going to be very middle of the road.
So it sort of makes sense they were fairly close together in that regard. Some other stats that I've sort of spotted and compiled and screenshotted from hither and thither. The interesting ones were driver average finishing positions. This one's quite interesting. I've obviously averaged out the finishing positions of all the drivers if they finish the race, it seems. And it shuffles things around a little bit. Verstappen comes out on top 1.275. So I reckon he'll be going for the 1.00 next year. I think that's going to be his end game here. Perez had an average finishing position of 4.2, though, so he's the second highest. There is a big gap behind Verstappen.
Curious. Just what I've got to say.
It's curious, but also as much as it speaks for Perez's up and down season, it speaks for Verstappen's sort of consistency. That was it. I was getting my T's in the wrong place. Consistency. Third place, however, up two from where he finished in real life with 4.88 as an average finishing position, Leclerc. So, of course, when he finished the races, he wasn't doing too badly. It was just a case of whether
finishing the races.
Or start them when it comes to things like Brazil. Obviously, that demotes Hamilton and Alonso down. They finished with 4.9 and 5.6 as average finishing places. Sainz goes up one, 5.68. Russell up one, 6.11. Norris, interestingly, drops two places in this. Average finishing position of 7.42. Stroll goes up one, as does Ocon, who goes up two, actually, with an average finishing place of ninth, which isn't too shabby. But again, that heavily relies on the whole finishing aspect. Doesn't mean he also overtakes Gasly, who finishes with 9.68. The other interesting ones are Bottas drops down the ranking. He loses two places with an average finish of 13.36. And Piastri, who has an average finish of 9.63, also drops two. So a couple of shuffles around when it comes to looking at the sort of average finishing places. It depends on how you read the season as to the story you get. And I did a little bit of digging into that as well. When you start averaging things out and look at points per kilometre raced, the constructors' standing shakes out as normal, apart from Ferrari and Mercedes, which swaps the other way around. Ferrari raced 638 kilometres less than Mercedes this season, though the equivalent of two drivers not doing a race at all, plus some. So over two Grand Prix less, yeah. And they scored more points per 300 kilometres, 10.07 points per kilometre versus every 300 kilometres versus 9.63 every 300 kilometres.
In theory, isn't that surprising considering you've got more points in less space there?
Yeah, so it isn't that surprising, but it's amazing that Ferrari was able to achieve that sort of efficiency.
A very Ferrari sort of statistic, I'll give you that.
But equally, doing it by 300 kilometres is roughly a Grand Prix. And that means that Mercedes per Grand Prix weren't quite scoring 10 points every Grand Prix, whereas Ferrari were. contrast Red Bull.
Not that it helped them.
Not that it helped them, but contrast that to Red Bull, who for every 300 kilometers they drove scored over 20 points, 20.04 by my average.
Because Max won most of them, so that's also not too surprising either.
Yeah, it means that they were essentially guaranteed an average of at least 25 because they won pretty much every race apart from Singapore. It's an interesting way to look at it when you start putting in the averages and the way that it tells a slightly different story. Speaking of sort of a different story, I think the big story, of course, was Max Verstappen's records across the season. And he now has a 100% completion record this season, every lap of every race, which I think is damn impressive, really, not only for his ability to keep it on the track, but Red Bull's reliability as well.
It's very silly. Very silly. I mean, it's impressive, don't get me wrong, but it's silly. And don't get me the wrong way. As impressive as it was, I'd be happy if I don't see that again anytime soon from any team, never mind just Red Bull. It's kind of like, okay, you've gone, you've done that. That's all very well and good. But can we get back to competition now, please?
Yeah, the dominancy is impressive as
you've got nothing between you the first time, Ferrari back with Schumacher, and Hamilton with Mercedes. We've kind of seen a bit of everything in terms of what dominance looks like. We don't need to see these other little bits where it's kind of like completing the video to 100%. You don't need those now. We've got 95%. We're happy with that. Leave it alone.
I mean, when it comes to completing the video game to 100%, there's a list of other stats that Max Verstappen's achieved. Most points scored in a season ever. 92% of all the points available to a single racer. He scored 92%. Essentially, that's an A-star performance. That's really quite impressive. Most wins in a season, most consecutive wins, most podiums in a season, most laps led in a season. First drivers lead more than 1,000 laps in a season and finished every race. Most sprint wins in a season. Obviously, the latter two are very much reliant on the modern style of seasons with sprint races and lots of Grand Prix to allow for lots of laps, but yeah, that's just a little bit nuts. Obviously, it's worth mentioning that, of course, Alonso and Leclerc tie on points, with Alonso winning out on countback, his wealth of third places beating Leclerc. So Alonso's strongest start to the season, despite the fact they didn't really play out as strong to a finish as we anticipated, was enough to really cling on to the relatively high finishing position, which is quite good.
Also doing Alonso things.
Yeah.
And Leclerc getting to miss out on kind of a very Leclerc thing as well, though.
Yeah, Leclerc doing Leclerc things as well, I think, is quite good. And of course, the finishing sort of order around that part of the grid, of course, Leclerc and Alonso 206, Sainz 200, and Norris 205 is very typical of sort of the exciting midfield or sort of behind the front row battle we've had this season.
Yeah, and I think it's Leclerc's last two races in particular really salvaged him there out of it, because again, it's also kind of Carlos luck and Ferrari luck for him to be the only guy to win a race outside of Red Bull and finish behind Leclerc.
Yeah, quite odd in that regard. I think that speaks a bit more for, despite his luck, Leclerc's consistency. Another interesting record we had this year was there was no British anthem on the podium for the first time since 1952.
Yeah, and as much as we could be annoyed at Mercedes for this, you've got to argue this year McLaren let the side down weirdly, because they had weirdly more opportunities to do so. And you just think, if Norris had decided to put up any kind of a fight against Verstappen in COTA, we could have had that, and we wouldn't still be taking the mick out of him for not winning a race. And he could have kept that streak going, but instead we've left that broken. And I hope that's not a sign of things to come, because that's just us from being British bias perspective. We're going to have a little bit of it, but it's just it's been on the podium for at least once a year every year since 52. It does seem right to say it's weird to not have it.
Yeah, it Yeah, Norris would have certainly brought it along. It's interesting that McLaren doesn't get the Kiwi national anthem because, of course, Bruce McLaren Kiwi, the team was founded by a Kiwi, but it's based out of the
UK. I was more
UK.
Thinking McLaren because Lando Norris would
having,
get it at least.
Yeah, Lando having it would at least give us the Brit. Yeah, but even that, yeah, but even if it was going to be one of the two drivers winning a Grand Prix, it would have arguably been Lando this season. That would have given us the British national anthem. Like I said, of course, we haven't had it since 1952. The first time we had the British, or the sort of start of that streak with the British national anthem, was Mike Hawthorn in 1953, where he won the French Grand Prix at Rennes with Ferrari. And that's, like, consider the huge structural changes that Formula One's been through since 1953, when it was giant naturally aspirated front-engined cars, to where we are now. The British Grand Prix has been sort of, it's been there. And then just
say, and that was been. A time where you could still get points for a Grand Prix finish if your car clocked out and you can push it over the line.
Yeah.
That's kind of how big a change we've had from then till now.
Yeah, if you came sixth by result, you came sixth and would get points, even if your car was on fire and upside down in a different bit of Germany to where the podium was. But anyway, speaking of Germany and rather Mercedes, they have been winless for the first time in 12 years.
Which is, yeah, again, it's partly...
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Down to the fact that they spent so long on the wrong design. Singapore was arguably their best time for it. Kota possibly could have been another one, but again, we would have lost out on that, which would have been very frustrating. But could have maybe saved the national anthem statistic, because even though it would have been taken away, we still would have heard it. So I guess that would have counted. And yeah, it's just kind of tracked where we expected them to be good year this year, Brazil being the obvious example. They just weren't, and it was a very curious thing to see. It's in that respect, the new regulations have shaped things up, but perhaps too much in a weird way there.
I think there's... It's interesting to have seen them tumble back so much, but hopefully they'll get themselves on.
Which, again, is weird to say, because tumbling back for them is still P2 in the championship and P3 for Lewis. So it's, and again, makes the statistic and their performance both that much more impressive and surprising.
Yeah.
They're kind of the Formula One equivalent of sticking a piece of toast on a cat and chucking up in the air, and we've created a vacuum.
Seeing which way it eventually lands, if it ever does. But we've found the paradigm where Mercedes is somehow great but not great, which is interesting. Another thing that's been missing from the podium this season has been a woman. Previous years, we've had obviously female members from all the teams come up onto the podium when they've won, but Red Bull didn't send anyone up this year. And I think when Ferrari won, I think it was fair enough for them to send up their team principal, because it was probably going to be their only chance for some time. So that's quite a shocking thing. We've always taken a step back when it comes to that sort of thing.
And you do kind of have to look at Red Bull for that, because no one else has really had much of an opportunity to do much about that. So the fact that of all the races they've won, and they didn't think to put up a woman at least once, especially when they've got Hannah Schmidt there, you'd think, at the very least, put her up there. You know,
yeah.
It seems a no-brainer for so many reasons, and it's just disappointing. I'm not mad, I'm just disappointed. Lots of other people are mad, and rightly so, but I'm going to take the parental high route here and say, you've really done bad there, kiddo.
Yeah, I think they could have gone down, even if it was very much the sort of the performative feminism of simply putting a woman up there to say they'd done it. But even
they could have at least put Max's mum up there, because she's arguably responsible for his racing genetics more than Joss is, with how much better she was at racing than he was back in the day.
True. She was
according to Eddie Jordan, if no one else. So, you know.
Yeah, I mean, can your parents go up onto the podium? That's an interesting question. We'll research that for another time.
Let's see why not.
It'd be great.
Make them a team representative and just a Mac t-shirt on them, job done.
Yeah, very true. So that's an interesting thing. But when it comes to sort of the actual racing action, there's one thing I do want to know, which is positions gained. And this throws up some interesting questions based on sort of not only qualifying, but also how drivers perform during the race. Most positions gained across the season goes to Perez, 104 positions gained across the season. Stroll, 58 gained across the season. Verstappen, 42. Zhou, 39. And Sargent, 33. Zhou and Sargent isn't overly surprising. If you start at the back, you've got more opportunity to get past people and make overtakes. And equally, drivers ahead will retire. You'll make up places that way.
Let's show how many times Perez started at the back. 104.
Yeah. This is the thing. Like, Perez obviously wasn't on it when it came to qualifying, but given the rocket ship of a car he had, he was able to make it up in the races, which is why he's got a number that's nearly double the next person on this list, which is Stroll, who was very much in the same boat, certainly at the start of the year.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Unable to really get it down in qualifying and then made up for it in the race just by simply having a quick car. Verstappen's, I can only think of being those times when he wasn't able to get a good qualifying, like Miami, where Charles Leclerc crashed out and denied him a good run in Q3. I think
potentially that, and then you've got like Sandport and Singapore, where you're either dealing with being out of position or you've got weather playing havoc and you've got a surprising number of overtakes going on because everyone's pitting every 2 minutes.
I think that would be about the only one, possibly Zandvoort, or races where he might have taken a grid penalty for taking newer elements. That'd be the only reason that he's even there. But of course, he made the overtakes because he's in a rocket ship of a car. So it's quite interesting to sort of see how even that very easily summates a season. You sort of go, well, there was some absolutely fast cars and then there was some people at the back of the grid. Speaking of people at the back of the grid, though, we get to the Destructors Championship. This is accumulated by a chap over on Reddit. I can't remember his name, but the final standings are, unsurprisingly, Sargent leads with 4,333,000 worth of damage accrued across the season. Verstappen at the bottom, he's finally lost something, which is because he only racked up $345,000 worth of damage to his car across the season, which is quite impressive. Russell somehow down in 19th on $670,000. One can only assume that's because it only takes into account damage done to his car, not other people's.
Yes, otherwise I feel like that would definitely go up.
Yeah. Interestingly, after Sargent, though, at the top, Sainz, 3,644,000. Perez, 3,224,000. So quite close at the top between Sainz and Perez as well, which shows that they might have been pushing a little bit beyond their comfort zones in their cars this season to have resulted in accidents quite so damaging.
No, there's not really much for me to add on to that particular point.
I mean, it's an interesting way to read into it, but it certainly sort of brings out some pieces here and there. And then again, you look at other drivers like Zhou and Tsunoda, only costing 1.2 mil a piece. Like, that's not really that bad when you consider the likes of Gasly, Albon, Magnussen, Stroll, Leclerc costing almost sort of over 2 mil in some cases. Leclerc,
I suppose, as well, it's being the younger, less experienced drivers of the two, especially when you look at the top end who's been at least expensive in terms of damage. It's all drivers who've been there for quite a while, with the exception of Russell. But Russell's generally been, like, if he has any contact with people, it's always a little bit to contact. And he doesn't crash himself all that often. When he does, it's more just little bits and pieces. It's not, Singapore doesn't happen all the time. And even that wasn't a massive crash. You could still tell that was a car. So it's impressive, I guess, that Joe and Tsunoda, maybe they're looking back on all these drivers at the top and thinking, okay, if I'm going to crash, I'm going to do it like that. So minimal damage in terms of cost. And let's face it, at this point, Yuki's crashed so much in his first season that he's probably used to doing the opposite by now. Like, yeah, okay, I shouldn't do this.
yeah, Yuki has finessed the ability to have an inexpensive crash, which is quite interesting. We'll do some other sort of team head-to-heads, and this one looks more at the driver's point shares, and leading that, unsurprisingly, similar to qualifying, it's Alex Albon with 96% of the points haul for Williams, Hülkenberg in second with 75, Alonso in third with 74, Tsunoda 68% of the points at AlphaTauri over his teammates, the same percentage share sees Norris in fifth, Verstappen 67% of the points, Bottas 63% of the points, Hamilton 57%, Gasly 52 and Leclerc 51. So who surprises you there most of all when it comes to sort of taking the big points hauls?
I don't think any of them do, to be honest. I think maybe Norris at 68% just because Piastri's been so strong this year, but I think it's easy to forget about the first half of the year where the car wasn't there yet. And then obviously Norris got more podiums than Piastri. I think everyone just kind of we expect it from Norris and we expect more from him in some ways. Whereas Piastri, we knew he was good, but we weren't quite sure what was going on, especially when the car wasn't that great. We thought, how are they going to be able to extract stuff out of it? Is he going to do what Alonso did back in the McLaren in the Honda days? And then it was just kind of when he got the car that was a little bit better, he was able to utilize that perfectly. But by then, I'm guessing the gulf was too big to match up. And also Norris is then doing what you know he's at the base level capable of.
Yeah, I think there's the interesting one for me there, though, is Bottas on 63% of the points. Well, I would have potentially anticipated him having a few more.
A lot less, I suppose.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I was assuming he would have a slightly more dominant season over Zhou than the.
I was expecting less, to be honest, because I'm just so used to him not finishing races.
At this point, so, possibly. Yeah.
So it's kind of one thing, but I guess just Zhou wasn't able to capitalize on scoring points when Bottas didn't finish, so that when he did, he got more than Joe Woodruff didn't score. So it kind of, you may finish more races, but that doesn't mean you're going to score points.
Yeah, not necessarily finishing in the points. And of course, one final sort of statistic before we move on to some more sort of analytical bits. It is, of course, 79 days until lights out and away we go at the Bahrain Grand Prix. I do have at one point a timer on here giving me the full sort of hours of it, but 79 days, at least at the time of recording, until it's lights out and away we go, the Bahrain Grand Prix. Do you think you're excited for it already? Are you looking forward to a slightly better season in 2024?
I'm looking forward to the idea of a better season in 2024 if we get that remains to be seen, and I'm not yet looking forward to it, to be perfectly honest. I've not had enough distance from 2023 yet. I'm grateful that there's 79 days between now and Bahrain. And undoubtedly, when we, not necessarily the liveries, actually, I'm not expecting much from the liveries next year, but maybe when we get a bit of testing, when we see if anyone's been able to do anything over the winter to at least tease us a bit in the way Aston Martin did at the beginning of this year with their testing performance in terms of getting close to Red Bull, then I think I'll slowly get there. But I think I probably won't get excited for it until 3 or 4 races in, where I'll be able to decide if I want to get excited for it or not, so I'll have an idea of what we're expecting. I think 2023 has shown in the numerous ways that you read out just now that how dominant Red Bull are and how much of a goal all the other teams have to bridge in order to catch up to them, and not just catch up, but then beat them at least more than once, which is how low the bar is from this year. So no, I'm not looking forward to it just yet, but I don't doubt that when the lights do go out in Bahrain, for a couple hours at least, I'll be like, well, you know, anything could happen. And it usually does.
Fantastic. So we'll move from the numbers and the statistics into something a little less quantifiable. And that, of course, as we have with our regular review podcasts, are the winners and spinners section. Timo, we'll start with you. Who was your winner of the season?
It was hard to think of one for a moment just because everyone had all right seasons if you look outside of Max Verstappen, but it's tricky. But I think for reasons that I said earlier, Oscar Piastri, for me, he's got to be the winner of the season because he did prove more or less from the off that he could get all of his mistakes, and there weren't many of them, out of the way early doors when the car was terrible and didn't really matter too much. And then when the car was upgraded a bit and not even necessarily when it was brilliant, but just when opportunities came his way, he could absolutely capitalize on them. And whilst it was only a sprint race win, it's still a race win for the sake of this argument, and he's got one of those over Lando, which does amuse me so very, very much. And he would win just because of that. If even if he'd been terrible for the rest of the season, he gets my vote for that one. And if this is how he's starting, I'm looking forward to seeing where we go next with him. And my call will be, not only does he win a Grand Prix race before Lando Norris, he will win a championship before Lando Norris.
I think that's, given his performance this season, is it's not unfair.
If I'm going to be very ballsy, but also depressing for any Ferrari fans listening, I think he'll win a championship before Ferrari did.
Yeah, I can't argue against that. Despite being a big Ferrari fan, I cannot argue that, given the form we've seen, certainly of McLaren, the fact that how fast and hard they're chasing down that front pack, we're going to see them possibly overtake Ferrari next season. I'm hoping Ferrari pull something out of the bag. I'm hoping they...
Which I must also just point out about McLaren. What a hell of a 180 I've had from the start of the year, where I pretty much looked at them after Bahrain and went, how fucked are they? And I now have to kind of walk back my words ever so slightly. Or it was incredibly tough love and they listened to me.
Yeah, possibly. It could have gone either way, really, with that one. It could have been the tough love. It could have been the fact that you might have just had to eat a colossal portion of humble pie and go, actually, they were able to resuscitate that season. And I think,
I inspired them.
Yeah, you can keep thinking that. I think Oscar Piastri's work, certainly, though, went a long way to that. And I think he got Rookie of the Year. I think it makes a hell of a lot of sense that he attained that award. And he was only really up against essentially Sargent. DeVries, Sargent, technically Lawson as well. But his performances across the board were undeniable, really. When it comes to my winner of the season, though, I think I've gone for the obvious choice. And I think it's for all the reasons I've already sort of gone through in the sort of stats section, which is it's Max Verstappen. He has driven pretty much the perfect season. Nothing that happened this year negative was his fault.
It's a very weak one option, but you can't fault it for a plethora of reasons that we were saying about earlier, statistics.
Yeah, it's undeniable. It is quite literally faultless. And I think for that, you can't deny him the accolade of certainly being the driver of the season. And yeah, for just simply being the...
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know, when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself, talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Guy, man, he was a worthy world champion this year, even if it was a bit of an easy world championship by any metric. On the flip side of that coin, the spinners of the season, Timo, who might yours be?
I was thinking about this and I thought, as funny as it would be to say Lando Norris, and as route one again, but perfectly logically as it would be to go with your option, I thought, and again, Perez was tempting, but he did get P2 in the Drivers' Championship, so he didn't really spin too badly in the grand scheme of things. And whilst this is also easy cannon fodder, Lance Stroll has to be the spinner, because when you look at what Fernando Alonso has been able to do with that car this year, I really, yet again, I'm going to make the point of, I don't know what else has to be demonstrated that he doesn't deserve to be in Formula One. He should have at the very least been on the podium once this year, sometime. And the fact that there was such a massive gap in points between the two of them is mental, but also not surprising at all. And even if he didn't get on the podium, there should have been more points on the board for him.
Yeah, I think he's certainly been the disappointment of the season. When, like you said, when you look at what Alonso was able to achieve with that car, the amount of podiums and how close he came at times to wins and stuff, 206 points, the fact that he was at one point battling for third in the driver's standings. Mm-hmm. And you look down to a guy that was just about able to scrape his way into 10th ahead of an Alpine and was beaten by a rookie whose season started out with a retirement of 15th and 8th, 11th and 19th. You're sort of going, oh, really, Lance? Is that the best you're able to do? And
the answer is yes.
Apparently so, yeah. Like, his best finishing position was a 4th, and that was the Australian Grand Prix, where Sainz was disqualified from it, and or penaltied out of the points rather, and so many other drivers ahead of him retired and crashed. So that's your best result. It's, yeah, not even cracking the 100 point barrier either, is when your teammate has cracked double that, is really saying something. And I think this season has been the one that's drawn it into sharp contrast.
Yours is perhaps more surprising, though, because we expected better and Obi deserved better.
Yeah, I went for my spinner of the season to be Kevin Magnussen. I know Henry over the Haas chap. He will not be happy at me pointing this out.
In some way, shape or form, but he's going to be sad about it anyway.
Yeah, at 3 points across the season, you've been sort of beaten by Zhou Guanyu. You've been beaten by Daniel Ricciardo, who did so few races. And your teammate absolutely trounced you with only one finish ahead of in the points. And yeah, Hülkenberg scored 9 points. I think he got one in a sprint race as well. Or a few in a sprint race, because he came sixth in Austria. But yeah, Magnussen, 3 10 P10s is 3 points. And it's not great when you're 1 point ahead of the guy that only did 5 races and was a rookie. It just wasn't the season that we anticipated it being for Magnussen. And yeah, the Haas was a bit of a dog this year. Easily the worst car on the field by the end of the year, with no appreciable sort of development that came through. He just made nothing of it. And Hülkenberg really had the measure of him, unfortunately.
Yeah, which says a lot for Hülkenberg as well, because he came in after a number of years out, if we talk about it properly, and just kind of crowned him and very much deserving his contract. And I'm not saying that K-Mag doesn't deserve the contract for next year, because the consistency makes sense there. Perhaps they need to do something and it's not going to be rookies. But I don't think anyone was expecting Hulk to come in that strong. And it's yet more proof that I really hope that Ask can give him a better car, or that he can get into a better car at some point, because I would love to see what he can do.
Yeah, because they are both very talented and very fast drivers when they're given a competent chassis. But as soon as you give them something that's recalcitrant and a bit of a tip, they start to struggle. Like, you look back to Magnussen when he started out at McLaren, he was fantastically fast and very good. And you look at Hülkenberg whenever he was given a decent chassis, like that time he stepped in at Racing Point when they were sort of going through the Tracing Point phase and they had a quick car. And he proved that he was a very quick driver and very quickly adapted to it. They are both phenomenal people behind the wheel. But it goes to show, if anything, just how bad the Haas has been across the year.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sort of looks like a bit of an oddball one to have as a spinner, but I think that the once you add the reasoning to it, it very quickly comes
into focus. No, it makes perfect sense. I think, yeah. If anything, I saw that and thought it's just a shame that that is so justifiable.
It is, yeah, I think at the end of the day, like you say, yeah, it is also a shame. Like,
with the spinners, you're normally going at them because they've done something stupid.
Lance Stroll.
Yes.
You're not going at them
because the season hasn't panned out. Been disappointing.
They've been let down as much as like the sort of team has let them down. It's just disappointing, really. We'll move from the winners and spinners to the overtake of the season. This took a bit of thinking for me. I don't know how much thought you had to pour into your one. I had to really sort of dive back.
My mind just emptied out every overtake, you know, the entire season. I was like, oh, none of them come to mind. The only thing I could think of was Alonso in Brazil on Perez at the end, because it was just so damn funny. But apart from that, it was like, right, I need to re-jog my memory slightly here.
Mm. And what have you gone for in the end?
Well, thanks to a handy reminder, I had a look. And despite Baku not being the most exciting race we've ever had in Baku, Alonso's overtake on Sainz on a part of the track where it really is not expected to be an overtaking place, but which does come back later on in our Formula 2 chat, which will be in another episode. You can actually overtake on this particular corner. I think it's turn 6, around there somewhere, I think, turn 4 or 6. And it was just a very nice, sublime move on the Ferrari, kind of sandwiching himself between the two of them and signs everything. Oh, crap, you can overtake that. Damn.
Yeah, it was a dive up the inside into a left-hander, so I think it might have been like turn 1, 2...
It was a right turn.
Okay, so then it would have been turn 4 possibly, or 5, 6, yeah. So, but yeah, it was just sort of a stick it up the inside, absolute send it on the brakes and make it work. And this was very much when Aston Martin was sort of getting to the
edge still in the performance
envelope. Yeah, it was still good, but other teams were getting good in comparison. And I think Alonso was making hay while the sun shone, really did with that overtake. And it was really quite a good one, and very reminiscent of a much younger Fernando Alonso in a much more competitive Renault, I dare say.
You've gone for one that was also very sublime, though, and was also very, very funny, because I do remember watching it at the time thinking, oh, go on, get him there. And he actually did.
Yeah, this for me, my overtake of the season is Charles Leclerc on Sergio Perez in Las Vegas. I think Charles Leclerc had some good overtakes in that race alone. There was the brilliant one he had tried on Verstappen around the outside, because it sort of came in two stages. He DRSs up to him, tries to get him on the brakes, and Verstappen has clearly outbraked him in the first phase. So Leclerc just lifts off the brakes and gets back ahead. But Verstappen just knows that he'll have the inside line into the turn, and Leclerc has to back out of that one. But by that point, Leclerc knows what the surface is like going into, was it the final turn, like turn 18, 19?
Yeah, in Vegas. Turn this year.
And he knows that he's got what the grip is like going into that. And he's clearly thought about it and has sort of been telegraphing this for laps before. And then on the final
lap... It was kind
of
a curious one, because you're looking at it thinking, I think he surprised us as much as himself that he actually did it and made it work, because everyone just... I think we all looked at that and thought, oh, he's too far back. And then he went for it. Not only did he go for it, but he made it.
Yeah, it comes from nowhere on Perez. Well played. Perez, the Mexican Minister for Defense. And Charles Leclerc just shoots one up the inside and vanishes. And yeah, while Perez has the power to chase him down and gets him just after the line, crucially, he gets him just after the line. Leclerc pips him to it and takes the points. And it was, yeah, just a case in point for the fact that of just how good a racer and a sort of strategist there is within Charles Leclerc. And I think the day he is given a competitive Ferrari is a day that Formula One will change. Although, like you've already said, that day could come after Oscar Piastri has won a championship.
Yes, which, who knows how soon or late that could be in the grand scheme of things. It's very hard to tell. Depends on Red Bull in some ways.
Really does depend on what Red Bull are able to achieve next year. Another interesting one that I want to talk about is crash of the season, and not necessarily because excitement of watching bits of carbon fiber spiraling across the racetrack, but more because of what it means for the season as a whole. And I think we've both picked races that have, or crashes rather, that have a bit more to say than simply ooh and ah. So team, I'll go for yours first.
Yeah, I was thinking in a few of the more recent races came to mind, Norris and Las Vegas being a good example, because of the camera angle that we first got for it. It was like, oh, Christ, what was that? And then it was like, oh, Norris, right. And, ooh, bloody hell, he was close to Piastri. But I think just for how to sum up a season, how to sum up, I'm really coming for the championship this year, and then coming P2, and the points difference between you and first place would have been enough for Max to secure the championship anyway. It has to be Perez's turn 1 crash in Mexico. because only Perez could do that at his home race and be out that quickly. And just, of course he did. Of course he did. So that is crash of the season, because it just works on so many different levels for describing 2023.
Yeah, it's that metaphor analogy, sort of you can read into it and describe the season from one crash, which is sort of what I was hoping.
It's like a massive franchise. You can watch as much of it as you want and there's something there for everyone. You can go really deep or you can just look at it surface level. There's going to be all kinds of levels of satisfaction to get out of it.
Yeah, it's a crash for GCSE English teachers. There's a lot to pick away from it.
Yes.
Yeah, the driver was sad because he was in a blue car. And of course, Perez was quite sad after that because, of course, he'd crashed out in a blue car. For me, though, my crash of the season is Ocon into Gasly in Australia. And I think it's quite obvious sort of what the deeper meaning from this one is, because, of course, it's the fact that Alpine sort of started off with this sort of, everyone started off with this concept of Alpine being a bit of a firecracker. We had two drivers that didn't really get along. They seem to have gotten along by the end of the season, bear in mind. They both seem to be sort of on pretty good terms with one another.
Mutual suffering.
Yeah, mutual suffering, because Alpine just sort of never really got good. They just had the world's most mediocre season, which is quite disappointing in a way.
Yeah, but as we were saying at the top of the podcast with the personnel changes and whatnot, it also was just not very surprising. And I think the only thing interesting thing they had for them at the start of the season was the fact that these two were meant to be quite argy-bargy with each other, and then nothing really happened there. You got a bit of team radio occasionally when one of them would ask why you prioritised the other. Usually Gasly asking why Ocon's ahead of him for no apparent reason, especially when they've had such a mediocre season. And that was about it. Just wasn't that interesting. And this was kind of it's demised their season as well, in the same way that Perez did in Mexico. Ocon and Gasly in Australia was very much, yeah, this is how your season's going to go.
Yeah, it is that crash that perfectly summates their sort of their efforts across the year. The same could be said for, again, I sort of jotted down a few other ones that are worth mentioning, and Norris in Vegas. I think that crash was very much sort of a testimony to the supposed excitement of Vegas, and equally the rush to build it, the fact that it was a very unleveled surface, and the fact that we were able to just sort of completely bottom out a car to the point that it suffered a huge high-speed crash. Albon and the Haas's turn one in Brazil was sort of very much Alex Albon battling against everything this year. Ultimately, for Nelt, it achieved a lot for Williams, but at times it looked like very much an uphill battle. Ocon, Hülkenberg and Perez in Qatar's sprint. Three drivers you're not expecting to come together, and certainly not in a manner quite like that.
No, but also at that point, it wasn't surprising considering Perez was one of the three. It was just kind of, who's Perez going to crash into this week? And here are the two lucky winners.
Yes, yeah, it was not very lucky in that instance for Ocon nor Hülkenberg. I think Hülkenberg got away with it quite lightly, despite the fact that he was very much the sandwich in that former Racing Point driver crash. Stroll gets three mentions actually on my little jottings list here, which was Stroll into Alonso in Bahrain, which was quite the interesting sort of crash tap nudge. Stroll into the barriers at Spa in the sprint shootout, and then Stroll into the barriers in Singapore Q1. Which one of those Stroll shunts stands out most to you? I know it's like trying to ask someone to pick a favourite child, but
he's got to be the first one, because only he...
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now, with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/arts. Just go to Indeed.com/arts right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/arts. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
You would somehow crash into Alonso at the first race of the season when there's so much promise coming your way, and then you think, oh my God, he's going to ruin this for everyone before we even got going. Why?
Equally,
and it's more thanks to the team and Alonso salvaging that rather than him just not doing a bad enough or good enough job there.
And equally, it speaks a lot for how everything else panned out, because of course Alonso asks who crashed into me and doesn't get told until after the race. Yes. That was his boss's son,
which is probably wise.
Yeah, so that it
you but also very amusing to hear the team radio silence going, how the hell do we not tell him? But how do we tell him? What do we do here, guys?
We don't know, we'll tell you later. It's very much sort of, again, one of those crashes that was quite sort of derivative of the entire season for certain drivers. I think it's quite interesting there. And the other ones I had on my list were Leclerc in Miami, which was an interesting crash. I think it was Leclerc driving hard to try and get into the championship fight that at that point in time, and what it ended up doing was costing Verstappen pole, which is quite remarkable. And then of course De Vries in Baku, which would have been, if you can wind the clock back to when Nick De Vries raced in Formula One, was a fairly hefty shunt from De Vries head on into the barriers. And I think this is where things started to unwind for him.
Yeah, it definitely didn't help. And I think he was not necessarily already on thin ice there, but it just didn't help, is the very short version of that one.
Yeah, I think it sort of set the tone for things to come, unfortunately, for De Vries and his career within Formula One, certainly as the driver at AlphaTauri. So we'll move on to our next section, which is the season predictions review. And this was at the start of the year. The three of us picked a load of predictions, and also we had a variety of guests who phoned in their predictions as well. So we had everything from, he says, flicking over to the right bit of the spreadsheet, our three bold predictions, drivers who will score podiums. We had to pick the team standings, the bottom five drivers, the top five drivers. Then, of course, we had rookie watch. So we pitted Lando against Piastri, Albon versus Sargent, Sonoda against De Vries. Of course, we didn't really know how that was going to pan out. Also asked,
I think the problem with all of these, the most was, for my predictions at least, was that I was anticipating a much more interesting season than the one we got.
I think a lot and of us might
kind
have
of, been. There was perhaps disappointment in the second half of the season in 2022, but there was enough gumption, I suppose, that and enough stuff from pre-season testing for us to think, maybe, and then no, not even slightly.
Yeah, so of course we had the French feud, so I asked people to pick the points difference between Ocon and Gasly. I asked for people to predict who will have the most DNFs. I asked, will Las Vegas suck? Wanted people to predict which race will have the quickest pit stop, their favourite race, their least favourite race, and simply to guess Bottas's points. Then we got some interesting ones across the board. There were some interesting predictions. Interestingly, very few people... It was sort of a mixed bag when it came to actually picking the winning driver. You and I were both quite optimistic with picking a Ferrari driver, myself, Leclerc.
So I picked Carlos Sainz, I think, yes.
Yeah.
Which, to be fair, the only solace I can take from that is the fact that I chose the one other driver outside of Red Bull to win a race.
This is very true. You were sort of on a roll with that one. Ellie May got that one correct. Across the board, picking the top and five bottom drivers, it proved to be quite tricky, actually. A lot of people didn't think very highly of Aston Martin coming into it. There's a lot of Lance Strolls very low down in the list. A lot of interesting people sort of picking people here, there and everywhere over other people. I think the most interesting correct prediction comes in the form of Kevin Magnussen and Nico Hülkenberg being correctly predicted as 16th and 19th by Magdalena, with 16th for Hülkenberg.
It would have been funny if it was Henry.
Yes, and Alice picking Kevin Magnussen for 19th. When we come to Henry, actually, he did not get any of his Haas-based predictions correct, unfortunately for him. He obviously put his Haas driver somewhere between P15 and P6, as they appear nowhere in the bottom five nor the top five.
At least he didn't put them P1 and P2. He was trying to be realistic a bit.
He was trying to be a little bit realistic, though he did put in Haas would get a podium this year, which they, of course, did not. Didn't really pan out for him there. The most interesting one, though, was the name every driver that will score a podium this season. This is quite a fun one to keep track of, because, of course, there is the added risk of, if you didn't pick a driver that would get a podium, I also docked you points.
Something I probably don't remember from pre-season at all, but...
Yeah, so I did quite well on this one within reason. Obviously, I picked Leclerc, Sainz, Hamilton, Russell, Norris, Verstappen, Perez, Ocon, Gasly, and Alonso, all of whom scored podiums. I also picked Bottas and Ricciardo to score podiums, neither of whom did. I also neglected to pick Oscar Piastri, who, of course, scored podiums. So, lost points in those cases. You did all right. You had pretty much the same pick as me. You remembered to pick Oscar Piastri, failed to pick Lando Norris, though.
I think that was me already at the preseason point going, oh, wouldn't it be funny though?
Yeah. You've also picked Bottas and Albon to score podiums, neither of whom did. You also neglected to pick Gasly to score a podium.
And again, to be fair, if you're Alpine or Gasly, if you're being kind to yourselves, you're probably going to agree with me at the start of the season. And again, where was his podium? What was it, Zandvoort?
Gasly?
There was technically two Ocon podiums, depending if you are the people in charge of putting the names up as the drivers walk onto the podium. But yes. In terms of where it actually was, I think it was Zandvoort, and I think whilst a podium is a podium, circumstances did help a little bit that day because Ocon was in Monaco, I believe. So yeah, that makes sense. It was two races where they definitely capitalized on the opportunity presented to them.
I mean, to be fair, Gasly did also podium at the Belgian sprint, so we knew he had that P3 ability in him.
Yeah, versus sprint race.
Yeah, he had that dog in him. He just sort of deployed it on the right weekend eventually. Most interesting selections for scoring podiums have to go Ellie May, who picked Nico Hülkenberg, Ben Wellum, who picked Kevin Magnussen to score a podium, Shannon, who picked Nick De Vries, as did Magdalena, which is interesting, as did Alice. So some interesting ones for podiums. And the most interesting of ignored ones, Alonso Perez was ignored at one point for a podium, which I cannot believe. Magdalena. another Alonso as well. So yes, I mean, an interesting mix of ignored and chosen when it comes to the podiums. Pretty much everyone said that Albon was going to outscore Sargent, so clean sweep across the board there. You predicted Piastri would outscore Lando, so you did not get points for that one.
I still want to be right about it.
Fraser fell into the same hole, unfortunately, so he also picked Piastri over Lando.
It'll happen next year.
Yeah, everyone else got Norris correct there. And a lot of people, myself included, picked De Vries outscoring Tsunoda. the only person to get that correct was Fraser, who picked Tsunoda over De Vries. So very interesting result in that one.
Yeah, I mean, on paper, coming into it, you've got a guy who has won two championships versus a guy who spun a lot during his first season and was already questioning why he got a contract extension. So you could see the logic from most people.
The logic was there, certainly. The French feud one was very interesting because there was a good spread of numbers. I picked 35-point gap between the French drivers of Ocon and Gasly.
What was the gap? Because let's face it, I don't know, but off the top of my head.
Do you want to take a guess?
No, I'm saying what was the actual point difference?
Yeah, take a guess.
Oh, I've no idea. 20?
4.
4. Okay, yeah. What did I guess?
You guessed 20.
Oh, I guessed 20 as well. That's quite funny.
Yeah. I think the lowest / closest guess would have been L.A. Wilshaw and Henry Haschap, who both picked 12 for that, but unfortunately were essentially a multiple of 3 out.
There's not really hard points for that one, unfortunately.
No, I did not award any points for that one. Same as I didn't award any points for which driver will have the most DNFs. I picked Sargent, you picked Stroll, Ellie May went Yuki, pretty mainstream options there.
Who did?
In the end, it was Ocon, 7.
That's a crunch.
Yeah, which I don't think is wholly surprising. We get into the slightly more sort of circumstantial questions here, which was, will Las Vegas suck? And this involved me after the Las Vegas Grand Prix then messaging a lot of people going, so what did you think of that? Don't ask me why. And I said the Las Vegas Grand Prix will suck, but I sort of reneged on that, actually. I quite enjoyed it as a Grand Prix, so I've docked myself.
That doesn't work your prediction, though.
No, you said that it wouldn't suck, and then also on the podcast said that it didn't suck, so I've awarded you the points for that one, so congratulations.
Yeah, again, I think for these ones, for rating a Grand Prix, I I can only take it at the race value, because if I take it at everything from when we rock up there on whichever day, Thursday or Friday, till the end of it, I would not be saying yes for many of them.
Oh, yeah, some of them were kind of dull. Certainly the showmanship of Vegas was a bit...
Okay, a lot of them were already losing on the racing front as it was, so the fact that Vegas' only redeeming quality was the race itself was quite amusing and typical at the same time.
This was very much a question of whether or not people were able to predict their emotions based around Las Vegas as well, which is quite interesting. Quickest pit stop, only two people got that one correct across the entire season, which was, of course, McLaren. That again went to Haschap Henry and Ben Wellum, who predicted both as McLaren. Ben Wellum, I'm concerned. This is a man that you and I introduced to Formula One in the 2022 season. We're both beaten by him in the season-long predictions there. And this year he's come out pretty nifty when it comes to scoring points, actually. I think Ben was our season-long champion on 69 points. This is a man in just his second season of Formula One.
Weirdly makes sense, though, at the same time. It's kind of the less committed you are, the more kind of not ballsy, but also semi-logical you're going to be, because you just pick names that look right and sound right to you and you base it off no real knowledge whatsoever.
Yeah, I'm not entirely certain how he pulled that one out of the bag, but yeah, he got 19 correct answers, 26 incorrect. I appointed 5 points for every correct answer, so he scored a total of 69 overall. The highest out of the three hosts was Ellie May on 52 correct.
Surprising.
Myself on 44 in second place, and you in third on 20, I'm afraid.
I was too optimistic about the season, so I don't blame myself for that one. I blame Formula One.
Yeah, it was not a strong round of year-long predictions from you. Some other interesting ones across 22. So you were beaten by Jacob, friend of the podcast.
Did anyone get less than me is the important question.
No one that I've got a full set of answers back from got less than you. So you're unfortunately the lowest ranked of all of the people. Yeah, beaten by Fraser, beaten by Henry, beaten by Shannon, beaten by Magdalena. Yeah, just a pretty abysmal result there.
Can't have it all.
You can't. You certainly can't.
I'd rather be ambitious with the predictions and lose outright and be like, well, that's a season for letting me down badly. Then everyone else is going a bit more one-to-one about it.
Yeah,
if my season had happened as the predictions would have played out, how interesting would it have been?
Very interesting. I think at the end of the day, your predictions were ambitious but rubbish, which is a perfect point, really, to wrap up this season review on, I think, unless you've got any final bits to add.
No, I think that also just encapsulated the 2023 season in a phrase.
Yeah, ambitious but rubbish. So we'll start our conclusion, which of course we obviously say a big thank you to our listeners, where we are still surprisingly popular in Barbados. If anyone is actually listening in Barbados, please let us know where we rank on like motorsport podcasts in Barbados. It'd be great to see how...
I think I looked at this once. We were quite high up.
Yeah.
We were like in top five for sport.
Oh. There you are. We are
weird.
But one of Barbados' top five sporting podcasts. And a big thank you goes out to our listeners in Fredericton, in New Brunswick, Canada. And of course, our Slovenian listeners. There is a large group of you in Ljubljana. So Vesel Bocic, I think, which should translate to Merry Christmas or Happy Christmas. In the meantime, Timo, where can the people find you?
You can find me over on the Curbs, on the Curbs Pub Chat, the Nitro RX Podcast, Is It Fast, and Paddock Sorority, and of course Instagram, because I'm always, well not always, but I'm consistently there. How about yourself?
Maybe I'll get an invite to the On the Curbs Pub Chat at some point in time. In the meantime, though, you can find me on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok as @JesseOnCars. And you can also find me writing for Classic Car Weekly. Our bumper Christmas issue has gone on sale today, literally the day we're recording this. So go and pick that up. It's out for 2 weeks on shop shelves and has all manner of Christmas countdowns and celebrations of all things old car in 2023. So please do that. Support print media. We'll be back shortly, I guess, for a review of all the feeder series action from across the year. And if not, we'll be back in the new year with some more motorsport-based nonsense and looking ahead to the 2024 F1 season.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/arts. Just go to Indeed.com/arts right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/arts. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.